From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional.
And you were listening in your car, and maybe you had a few friends over, maybe you were in your house, whatever. Everyone had nice stereos with big speakers back then because that's what you did, right?
Unfictional is a program of true stories, personal documentaries, and radio movies. And on this episode, The Man Inside the Radio, a story about LA's rock radio history and mine. And this is the final episode of this podcast season. All of them were conceived and made weeks before we all had to go inside and stay. But the stories on the season are all about fantasy in one way or another. It's a dark time, and the hope is that these stories will transport you somewhere else for a little while. It's also the 10th year of Unfictional, which began in fall of 2010 as a radio program. And I still think of it as a radio program, even though it's a podcast first now. So on this episode, a personal appreciation of radio in two parts. It's Unfictional and The Man Inside the Radio.
So, hi.
How you doing?
Bob, how are you, man?
I'm good.
It's been like, what, 35 years?
I know. You sound like I remember you sounding, though.
Yeah, I don't look the same, though.
I talked to Jim Nelson, veteran radio DJ, programmer, industry journalist. We've both worked around radio for a really long time and went to high school in the same era.
We didn't have YouTube on our phones in our pockets. We didn't have the internet. You either had radio in your car or you had a cassette or an A-track in your car. And that was it. There was no other options.
And it was during this conversation that I remembered something I'd forgotten. Why radio? I couldn't remember what made me consider radio, of all things, as a career. My college major was radio, but it's an industry now that seems like a relic of a different time. And in fact, Jim reminded me of the time when radio was Godhead, and why it seemed so epic and loomed so large in my formative years. It was specifically rock radio.
It was a time in our lives. You and I happened to be in high school and college when rock radio in Los Angeles was really good. That's the time in your life when music has an opportunity to play such a huge role because you don't have the responsibility of a mortgage and family, and you can go to Licorice Pizza or Tower and buy three or four albums for $20.
Little Feet's Waiting for Columbus on Warner Brothers Records. Now just $5.69, the tape $6.99 at Licorice Pizza.
And radio was KMET, the musical lifeblood of high school.
This is 94.7 KMET Los Angeles. It's about 2 minutes before midnight. 2 minutes before the change of the day.
All hail the American night.
They were so big and such a major force in this town in the late 70s.
KMET was the default soundtrack for surfers and stoners, for one thing. I was neither, but it was a significant constituency of my Southern California high school.
And you were listening in your car, and maybe you had a few friends over, maybe you were in your house, whatever. Everyone had nice stereos with big speakers back then because that's what you did, right? I remember that the music mix was perfect. Like, every song was good. Every single DJ knew everything about all the music, and they were all interesting to listen to.
Hey.
Yes, my little salamander.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, you tipped up.
I'm Jim Ladd, and I'm sitting here minding my own business, and who should walk through the door? Oh, look out. Look out. Breaking half the men's hearts in Long Beach.
You know, you'd have Cynthia Fox, Bob Coburn, and Jack Snyder, or as they would call him, Jackson V. Schneider Fishing Hell, is what they would name him. Paraquat Kelly, Mary Turner, Jim Ladd.
They were cool and very prominently political. Anti-Nixon, anti-Reagan. The station led official protests against nuclear power plants and in favor of marijuana legalization.
But you're just a number. That's it. It's a number, just a digit on some tape somewhere. So it bothers me a lot, you know, and bothered Bob Seger enough to write this song called Feels Like a Number. So as I play this song, I'm going to light up a number, and you know, just for the cause, I figure we remove them. We remove them one at a time, and sooner or later, if everybody, burned 2-3 numbers a day, pretty soon there wouldn't be any left. Anyway, this is KMET Los Angeles. I think that's right.
And, oh, by the way, they got paid for it.
It was the height of rock radio power. You could see eye-catching KMET billboards all over town, usually hung upside down to make them even more eye-catching. I definitely understand why I would have thought of it as a prestige job when I was in high school.
Levi's cord flares and Levi's denim flares are made to last.
When my clock radio went off every day, the first thing I heard was the morning team of Jeff Gonzer and Ace Young.
At Mervyn's, back-to-school sale today.
At Mervyn's today.
Thanks, Merv. Love your jeans and your chromosomes aren't bad either.
Many major world events of the late 1970s I heard first from Ace Young.
News is here for 9, more 10. I'm Ace Young. You're up to date. It's KMET Informs, Southern California. Now KMET Rocks, Southern California. Rock and Roll Tuesday morning and Jeff Gonzer.
And Tom Petty. And the Heartbreakers. KMET.
There are two important events in my early life when rock and roll radio stopped being a fantasy and I got to see it being made in person. Here's the first one. Once a month, Jeff Gonzer and Ace Young would do broadcasts from a venue that used to be called the Country Club, which was in Reseda in the San Fernando Valley, an hour's drive from my house in the South Bay. I got up before sunrise one Friday morning during the summer and drove to Reseda, and for the first time, I saw people in real life doing radio.
I'm Jeff Gonzer. It's finally a Friday on a Thursday from the Country Club.
The Beatles on Ed Sullivan launched a million bands. Seeing Jeff Gonzer and Ace Young live at the Country Club made me want to do radio.
LA's own answer to the Two Stooges.
Are we really on the radio?
Yeah,
now?
How about this, guys?
Wow. The
fact that we were in a rock and roll venue made people do all the things they'd normally do in a rock club. Drinking whiskey and Coke, for example. But now it was 6 o'clock in the morning.
I think we did them once a month with different themes and different guests. And it was insane.
This is Jeff Gonzer.
And as far as drinking goes, the waitresses who worked the night before, whoever it was, the Country Club, would stick around until 6 o'clock in the morning because the tips were infinitely better from our audience than they were from people who were coming to see some band.
From your perspective, what was the KMET listener like at the time? I was, you know, a suburban kid who drove in from the South Bay.
Well, they were you guys. They were people in their 20s. There were people who were looking for a soundtrack of their lives. Our listeners were people looking for something to identify with that wasn't kind of plastic and prepackaged and something that was very relatable. Getting stoned, surfing. It was that ultimate Southern California lifestyle.
10:06 and a half. I'm Ace Young. You're up to date. It's KMET Informs Southern California. Now, ladies and gentlemen, KMET rocks Southern California.
It was a terrible place to try to do the news.
This is Ace Young.
You know, it's too noisy in the background. And by the first hour, I'm not going to do the news anyway. People are passing around way too many things.
All right. We've done 3 hours already. Can you believe it? We'll be back. KMET rocks the hell out of Reseda.
Cool. 1972 I started, and I was there for 14 and a half years. In fact, I think I have the record for the longest person ever to be there. Maybe Dr. Demento with his Sunday night show there was longer.
I almost forgot to mention, Dr. Demento originated out of KMET, the weirdest thing to listen to the night before school the next day. KMET was one of a group of commercial rock stations in the country who had their roots in the underground rock radio movement of the late 60s, where old-time rules of on-air behavior were being rewritten. It was an attitude of doing whatever you could come up with.
And I couldn't imagine being in a better time for radio than I faced during those days. For example, we were doing the underground nuclear test in Nevada, and they would tell us exactly when they would take place, like at 12 noon or something. And they wanted the public to know, too, because they did shake Las Vegas. And we were talking to the maitre d' at top of the Dunes Hotel with his champagne glasses all filled with water to see if they would jiggle when the bomb went off, you know?
Wait, that was real? Or was that a joke thing?
No, that was real. That was real. And the maitre d' was such a funny guy. So to be able to do those live on the radio and, you know, have the guy at the top of the dunes where there was more sway and stuff like that, we just milked it for everything it was worth.
When you want a sound that's clear and high, and you want to kiss the hiss goodbye.
As a teenager, I was pretty straight-laced, so I didn't party as hard as the KMET lifestyle, but I could still enjoy the wild ride. In the same way, I didn't surf, but it was entertaining to listen to the Surf Report.
BASF Pro 2 Chrome cassettes at the Federated Group.
I know that guy. Here we are, Tuesday morning, 94.7 KMET, checking out the surf.
Morning, Ace. Gabriel Wisdom here in La Jolla. Surf is...
I mean, the first thing I did when I went to KMET was, there's no effing surf report. Someone living in the San Fernando Valley doesn't know if it's foggy in Malibu or if it's breaking.
It's a beautiful day. Waves, they're breaking 1 to 2 feet. Ow!
For the South Bay, this is the flavor for the Redondo Chart House.
The surf report became huge. In fact, some of our surf reporters were actually sponsored, and they were pulling down, you know, $1,500 a month just for sponsoring the surf report.
I remember those guys.
From Horizons West Surfboards in Santa Monica, this is Jennifer. We have another warm, sunny day, and the surf is about 1 to 2 feet with fair shape.
Until I talked to Ace Young, I don't think I fully appreciated the quality and depth of the KMET News Department, a rock and roll station.
The idea that we would have correspondents all over the country, all over the world, say, in London, this is so-and-so for KMET News. You know, that was so cool to do that. And whenever we did some great coverage, if it were a local story, at the end of the story, I'd say, KMET, ahead of the times. And the times, of course, being the reference to the Los Angeles Times.
And Ace Young hired Pat Paraquat Kelly as the afternoon news guy. He was part of the idea of making news fun and interesting rather than something you just tune out.
Tell Pat to do a story from the Hollywood Bowl, and it would be from the Hollywood bowling alley or whatever, just whatever we wanted to do, you know?
His most memorable feature was probably his salacious fish report.
Frisco's Landing up in Wesson County reports 23 anglers, 9 hook-nosed necrophiliac carp, 45 psychosomatic weasel.
Fish report with a beat, yeah.
Yeah.
And some of that stuff, I don't think it'd be on the radio anymore. Some of the names of those fish, frankly.
Was that the crushed route rainbow trout?
Yes, it was.
Hey, that's
rare.
My favorite. I like to fry those right up in a pan
so
full of
rare.
Hog jowl pudding.
Mm.
Mm, the weather is next with the Burner Mary Turner.
It is true that when you listen to the old KMET recordings, a lot of the jokes sound really cringy now. There's a lot of objectification of women and humor that hasn't aged well. But for the times, it was all in the service of the KMET style of freewheeling fun. They were into whatever their listeners were into. And when they wanted to, KMET could mobilize that connection with listeners. Pat Paraquat Kelly got his ironic nickname from an herbicide used against cannabis fields in Mexico in the early 1970s. Paraquat was used to kill cannabis, but it could also kill people. And the United States was assisting in the spraying, so KMET was really involved in the protest to get them to stop.
And then having rallies from San Diego to Santa Barbara, collected 2 million signatures. And for me to follow that up and deliver those 2 million petitions to President Carter at the White House. It's just not only covering a story the way we should cover it, and no one else was covering it, by the way, but to the very end and getting them to stop the program.
Ace Young is somewhere in Washington, D.C.
Tomorrow's a big day, not only for me, but for the
thousands of Southern Californians have participated in this incredibly successful program, and I'm just happy to see it go to fruition at this point.
Well, Ace, we'll be looking forward to talking with you tomorrow, and have a good stay in there. The big dome? Washington, D.C.?
Big dome, the big peanut plantation.
I listened to KMET all through high school. It always just kind of felt like a clubhouse, like everybody was just sort of hanging out, ready to do their thing. I mean, what did it feel like to be there?
Felt like a clubhouse. We were just kind of screwing around.
Here's Jeff Gonser again.
But I think that was one of the problems with our longevity. We didn't really take it as seriously as a business. That may have been the reason why it was so much fun for us and for you to listen to. And, you know, because we felt like the audience was all part of this grand collective. You know, it was like a supernova.
Right as I graduated, KMET was at the height of their popularity. But this was the peak of 70s rock and roll radio. Even though it seemed like they were doing it for fun, KMET made a ton of money and helped create the whole idea of classic rock.
The biggest heyday for KMET when we influenced an awful lot of people and the industry and kind of was a template for rock and roll radio stations was 1976 to 1984. And then it was kind of struggling. And as soon as the company started dicking around with the format and bringing in consultants, it was the beginning of the end.
Plus, KMET had competition. Their rival rock station was KLOS, but the stations also traded staff back and forth as fortunes changed.
I mean, we've talked about KMET quite a bit in this conversation, but KLOS was also really good at that time, and so you had two really good rock and roll stations in Los Angeles when we were in high school and college.
When I was 2 years into college and taking an intro to broadcasting class, they had a big book of internships, and I got one in the programming department of KLOS, my first official position, albeit unpaid, as a man inside the radio. That's coming up in a moment. From KCRW, it's Unfictional.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
From KCRW, it's Unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, and an episode called The Man Inside the Radio. If you're going to be coming to a radio station for the first time, this was fairly intimidating, too, because, you know, for years, if you live in Los Angeles, you know, every now and then are driving up and down La Cienega Boulevard, and you'd always see the big signs that said KLOS, KABC, and you'd go like, oh, I wonder what that's like inside, you know, not just anybody gets to go in there. And then to be actually parking in the parking lot and then going through, and there's like a security desk where you had to check in. And then you'd walk in, and then immediately there would be the programming office where.
Oh yeah, if you don't turn left immediately, you miss it.
Yeah, so you're inside, but just inside,
just barely.
Yeah. You've been hearing my colleague Jim Nelson, radio veteran. This is where I worked with Jim 35 years ago. We were the interns.
We've had our careers, and it all started right there, and what a great way to get it started, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Can you describe how you looked like in those days?
Yeah, I had shoulder-length hair and always had a beard, always wearing jeans or shorts and tennis shoes and definitely a rock and roll T-shirt, and sure, I had, you know, long dangling earrings. I was living the lifestyle, so I looked like somebody who probably worked in rock and roll.
And for about a year, I, short hair, button-down shirt, slim jeans, lived the rock and roll lifestyle as an intern at KLOS. I was a fly on the wall as rock and roll characters passed through the studios. I saw the dudes who sang that Radar Love song and the dudes from Journey. Tom Petty was there, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. Stevie Nicks looked at me this one time. But it didn't really feel like a clubhouse. By this time, rock radio was a cutthroat business. One close eye was always on the ratings. The morning man was Fraser Smith, who is now direct competition to Jeff Gonzer at KMET. I always remember, because when I was coming in, they would be finishing, and he was always in show mode.
He'd walk through there to go in and have a meeting with his boss, so that was what was on his mind.
And it was on a very, 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 very super long hallway.
Yeah.
Recall. We were at one end of the hallway, and then there'd be like studios.
Which are about halfway down on the left, yeah.
You know, occasionally when you'd go into the DJ booth, because it was all vinyl records, and so the DJ booth always had to have the most pristine copies of each record, and so occasionally you'd have to walk from the programming office and hand deliver a fresh copy of a vinyl record to the DJ, and I was always crazy nervous, like, am I going to open the door at the wrong time? Am I going to cough? One DJ who was off and on during my shift was Bob Coburn, and he had been one of those DJs on KMET I'd listened to, but now he was over here at KLOS. He was always so cool, and he was the first one to, like, he started showing me, like, how everything works and, like, how at this point the audio compressor will kick in. I had no idea what an audio compressor was at that time, and I go, oh, interesting. Our main job was to maintain the LP vinyl records that were in the current play rotation of KLOS. If the records got scratched, we got to call the record companies and get new copies. And this was where you got a little bit of a sense of power as an intern, because if you got to just call the record company from the Rolodex and just ask them to send another one, and they would.
Yep, we need five more copies of Boston's debut album, please, and five copies of Fleetwood Mac Rumors and five copies of Led Zeppelin III.
But this was a whole different time for music, 1983. At this point, a lot of listeners were tuning into the more punk and new wave KROQ, and in the KLOS programming department, there were discussions of what even constitutes rock and roll.
Got to tell you, things are very hard to say.
You know, where do the Bangles, where do A Flock of Seagulls or ABC or the Thompson Twins fit on the spectrum of Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Jackson Brown, Bruce Springsteen, and Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, Great White? So you almost had the old guard, which wasn't really that old at the time, the classic rock that is now known as Pink Floyd, Jackson Brown, etc.
My intern partner, Jim, was primed for the rock and roll life, so he was hired out of the internship after a few months. And he stayed at KLOS for a long time.
I worked there for 5.5 years altogether. And by the time I left, Bob, I was actually the interim music director by the time I left.
So you used it. You went places. I'm sort of an introvert anyway. So I think, you know, it takes me months even to get comfortable anywhere. So I don't think I ever felt I went anywhere beyond the nervous intern phase at any time that I was there. In real terms, I was only there for about a year. But I was hoping Jim remembered something more than I did. Do you remember this guy who was a funny guy? He was always dressed like a skater. And one day he laid down this LP record down on the desk. On top of that, he put one of those little bus things that drives around the record. And then it has a speaker on top and it plays it. And he was playing Thriller.
No.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
Vaguely.
Do you remember when I was standing on a desk to reach a high album and my knee gave way and I crashed down on top of our supervisor, Lynette, the assistant to the program director?
Wow. I had not remembered that until you brought it up. Yeah, that was weird.
I had this weird knee issue when I was a teenager. Everybody looked at me like I had lost my mind, like I was attacking Lynette. I left college in Southern California and went to school in Boston for two more years, where I was introduced to punk music, Run DMC, and the world of public radio. But KMET was my station in high school, and it's the soundtrack to all those memories, good and bad. KLOS was the first radio station I ever set foot in, and it set the idea of what a radio station looks like. Even today, as I do this program from the closet of my house, I salute the rock radio gods of the 1970s.
Conquistador, your stallion stands in need of company. And like some angel's haloed brow, you reek of purity. I see your armor plated breast has long since lost a sheath.
From KCRW, this is Unfictional, and you were listening to an episode called The Man Inside the Radio. It was written and made by me, Bob Carlson, with big thanks to Jeff Gonzer and Ace Young and my old intern buddy, Jim Nelson, who nowadays you can hear weeknights in Los Angeles on 88.5 FM. Please be sure and subscribe to Unfictional wherever you get your podcasts and catch up on this season's episodes you may not have heard yet. On this season of Unfictional, Chrissy Barker swooped in to provide vital production assistance, which included, but was not limited to, playing the musical saw and singing in a siren-like way. We say goodbye and thanks to the award-winning managing producer of the program, Carla Green. Support from KCRW included episode graphics by Alex Cirilla, digital content by Drew Tewksbury, web support from Christopher Ho, and thanks to Kristen Lepore of KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Theme music by Alex Weston, with music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. This season of Unfictional is dedicated to my KCRW colleague and close friend, Matt Holtzman, who was born on Halloween and died on Easter 2020 of cancer. He was a great producer, motivator, and educator, and he liked to have fun. I'm Bob Carlson. Thank you so much for listening. Take care of yourself, and please join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.